Bonnie Donnie, everyone. This Professor Amon Ra, Professor Emeritus, California State University of Long Beach, former City Councilman for the City of Compton, Professor Emeritus from California State Long Beach, and former City Councilman for the City of Compton, former Compton College Board of Trustees, and former Compton Unified School District Board of Trustees, and longtime student of Cowie the Philosophy, created by Dr. Maulana Karenga. And I just want to say how much I appreciated the tribute on my birthday. I'm sorry I couldn't be there. I want to thank Rasha Key for putting it together and all the comments, the beautiful comments, very heartwarming, and a beautiful prize, beautiful, beautiful gift for my birthday to listen to the kind words. And then you see Sister Adrienne Byers. She's an attorney. Yeah, she went on to become one of LA's top attorneys. She worked for a lot of top people. And Brother Ijao and my son, Shahid Ai, and Brother Mashinda and Rasha. All those are great words that people appreciate. Brothers and sisters, we in demanding, dangerous, and difficult times. And we've always been in those, you know. So today we need to talk about the issues of the day. And there are so many that blows your mind, the reality that people are shocked what they see what America is doing. And that's because their eyes were full of cobwebs of the illusion of inclusion, as Joe Hembrick would say. And they were in the white right wing is a cult of Trump. Many black people have become a cult of America, and they didn't see it for its reality because they would be dismissive of its history, and it didn't open their eyes as far as the true reality of America. What it advocates is one thing, and what it do is another. And that's why Haji Malik Al-Shabazz, Malcolm X, would say democracy is nothing but disguised hypocrisy. And for those that study America and study its history and learn from it, its origin and its dynamics as far as how it became a country and a powerful country. I didn't say good country. Powerful from the standpoint of being able to impose its will on people, not only through military apparatus, but also through cultural absorption, what they would call when you acculturate someone. So many of the Africans, Latinos, and Asians, Americans, they became Americans. And so in becoming American, there's certain things you have to be. One is patriotic. Patriotic. Totally believe in the American dream, advocacy. Totally believe in the goodness of America. And the euphoria is that as long as you give the people plenty of food, sex, and feelings of aspirations and about themselves and getting the illusion that they are better than other countries and better than other human beings and living better because of the advertisement and the advocacy of America. You know, it's like you meet somebody that's humble. You know, and Ernest can remember this. You ask why some people still stay in the South as bad as it is, where they become, accustomed to it, and their aspirations or their vision of where they go and how they're going to live, they live within the boundaries that environment set for them, and they feel comfortable living within them and functioning in them. And if they get out of it through sports, entertainment, or some economic endeavor that got them together, some move out, some just stay there and buy more property and do things. But they're happy, and they feel good. But this whole country got like people upset about the voters redistricting.
Yes.
They've been redistricting. They've always redistricted. They always gerrymandered. They always suppressed. Remember, it was a time when not only did they gerrymander the black vote, they wouldn't even let you vote. You remember that? And remember, the Supreme Court was right there with them. 1789 is when the first Supreme Court started, and 1790 is when they first convened. But they ruled on fugitive slave laws. They ruled that it was okay to enslave and that we were property. This was the Supreme Court, that said these things. And the legislation, they only would, you couldn't even vote, only white men. And then they had black people that they appointed that didn't was insignificant because it was only one or two. And so they didn't care about that. But I just want you to understand the history of America and its viciousness. I mean, we just forget about what they did to the Native American. One of the most dynamic genocides, along with ours, a Holocaust, really. We wiped out the whole nation of Indians, got them fighting each other, giving them liquor, giving them guns, pitting one against the other, and things of this nature. And then paying others to help them hunt down other Native Americans and to take their land. The white people that came here first, the colonies, they didn't fight their way here. They came as guests. That's where Thanksgiving came from. The Native American was naked and saw them coming in and taught them how to survive. And as they got stronger, they got here, they had a different agenda. And that agenda was to take all the land, not some of it, not just a bit of it. That was, you see, what white people are doing in Palestine. They call themselves Jews. Like the white people here call themselves Americans. The only true American is the Native American, who is a mixture of African and Asian. But people don't know that history, and they don't want you to know that history. They don't know. They don't want you to. They tell you you can't get reparation, but they gave incentives for white people to come here, gave them land. They had land grabs. They gave them resources. I mean, it's different. It's different. The Native American, most of his weapons was for hunting and protection. They didn't come with a concept of conquering other Native Americans and taking over their villages and raping their women like this guy did, with disease and other things. So what I'm trying to say is that today, it amazes me how people are surprised. Oh, they used to hide their racism. They never hid it. I mean, that throws me off. They've been killing black people, lynching black people throughout history. denying them rights and segregation laws, Jim Crow laws throughout history. And they say, oh, like racism just started. You know, there's some good white people. Yeah, long as they on top. You know, long as they got the power. So those are the dynamics that throws me off. And as Ernest was talking about, his father didn't even want to talk about the South. Most of our parents didn't want, because they knew that this man would kill you, like they killed their material. And that's why many people who left the South didn't go back. But the majority of black people still live in the South. And that's where that whole three-fifths of a vote comes from. You know, only three-fifths of the black population can vote to make sure. That's where the Electoral College come from. You can be the popular. Right now, they're taking over El Salvador, but they're not going to make El Salvador a part of the United States or call it a state. They'll call it a territory, like Puerto Rico and things of that nature. And then the same thing with what they're trying to do to Cuba. They ain't gonna make Cuba a state, because then you have a people of color that's United States senators and congressmen. You see what I'm saying? So Ernest, give us a little your perspective on that, Ernest.
Well, I've always, you know, just like what you're saying, because by me growing up here in Long Beach, but all my friends, because the first friend that I met was from Texarkana, Texas, came out, and I'd always know, and then the second, maybe third one, they came from Louisiana, New Orleans, and then I had a couple to come from Oklahoma, where they had that the Wall Street. His parents, he grew up under that. And then I always noticed that they had it was a kind of a hatred there toward white. And I really didn't understand, because I grew up here, you know, like in Long Beach, and, you know, from grammar school on, you know, I didn't get bullied by any white, because I was the bully in the class. And then, you know, going through junior high, so I can say I really didn't face it, because my dad even used to talk to me about it, say, well, you don't know, so that white man is something else. And I never really fully understand what he meant by that until I started to see it growing up. Because, you know, even going on different jobs, you find racism, but then I found one thing about the white guy, you know, because I had a lot of friends that I worked with that they was white, and I really didn't have that racial problems with them, because a lot of times I was in charge of different jobs, because I think but then I realized afterwards, I come along, and the first job they put me on was work on an aircraft carrier, and I hadn't been shipped 2 or 3 days, and guy sends me out there to Pier 1, and this Jewish guy I worked with named Prince, he was always challenging everything that the foreman would tell him to do. But I noticed they tried to, we were, you know how in the military they do what they call field days, every Friday you clean up. And so I was standing there, and they had mop buckets and stuff. And I had my head turned, and this kid Prince threw me a mop, and bam, and I saw it come and put my hand up and it hit me. And then I was kind of shocked. The foreman, he was white, you know, but he was Jewish. But the foreman was trying to get me. Well, I wouldn't take that, Ernie. He did that on purpose. And he he had apologized to him and said, "No, I didn't earn it. I didn't, but I'm not a violent person. You know, it took a lot to get me going." And so I kind of saw that coming. I said, because I come on and told my wife about it. I said, "We get in a fight and then they could fire both of us," because they was always trying to get rid of him, you know. But I began to kind of see that with a lot of my friends, but, you know, not being able to experience it. And then it didn't really fully hit me that how much my dad really hated Little Rock, Arkansas, and Mississippi is when I told you before we went on my wife's family had a reunion in Georgia because she's from, was born in Hartwell, Georgia. So they had a big reunion there, and I took my dad, and this was like about 1994. And when I told him, "Hey, Dad, you want to, I'll rent a car and stay here a couple of weeks and we'll drive around where you grew up, you know, and all that." And he looked at me and said, "Well, why?" You know, and that kind of summed it up for me, because I just went back in history up to the present, and I can see, because that kind of hatred, I don't know if I could have that kind of despise. I would more or less say he despised him, you know, because he worked with a lot of whites. But I know he used to tell me, you know, he's really something, so you'll find out. And I'm kind of fully beginning to understand that now by going through these Black history sessions. And like what Amon-Ra, you said about Cal State Long Beach, where the Black history students had their graduation this week. I think it was Monday. So the BS Black Studies is still going on at Cal State Long Beach, and it's bigger than ever, you know. So that's kind of what you started. You're on mute, Dr. Ra, you're on mute.
Ernest, I'm just going to say that your father was a liberator, and he put backboards in the back of some people and made them stand up. He led to the first election of a Black city councilman in Long Beach, Jim Wilson. Long Beach was a small Black community. You had Coleman's restaurant, you had Kelly's bookstore, you had VIP Records, you had P&G Fish, and we just lived right there off of California for the most part, and ended up there at the park off of Lemon and things of that nature. But it was a close-knit community. And you had 5555 with your brother-in-law, Willie Martin was the director, and then Jimmy Swan, who later became a minister of Muslims. So you had what your father ignited, along with Joe Croom, Mr. Croom, and a few of the other brothers, a willingness to fight, and some of the Black ministers. Your father took a position at Long Beach. That made Black people step up. You wouldn't have a Topsy. You wouldn't have a Smith who became mayor. And you wouldn't have councilman. I forget what the D. Andrew. Mm-hmm. Most people just focused on Long Beach Poly. That's when all Blacks went to Long mm-hmm. Beach Poly. They didn't go to Wilson. They didn't go to Jordan. They didn't go to Millikan and all of that. They was right there at Poly, and that's what made Poly such a powerhouse in sports. But and to this day, you have people that still who went to Poly in the 50s still going to their games and going and participating and supporting with boosters and things of this nature. But that was then. But this is the same thing with Mashinda in Louisiana. When they passed that redistricting and gerrymandering thing, the people in Louisiana were ready for them. They had massive demonstrations. Mashinda, are you there? Are you there, Mashinda?
Yes, I'm here.
Tell us about that movement up there, because they had a beautiful rally this past weekend in Louisiana, and the people are fighting. I know when you first came on, you know, you get they were like, they weren't fighting. But now, a lot of them are standing up. Cleo Field and a few others are fighting. What's it like out there now, Machinda?
Well, they're fighting. I said a lot of them are reacting. You know, these folks have been asleep at the wheel. You know, I talked about that a long time ago, and that's why it's in the position that it's in. You know, it's not like, you know, it was a resurrection of the freedom fighters or anything. You know, it's just people are starting to see the writing on the wall. You know, so you're right. So hopefully, you know. But you know, we've been trying to wake up the dead for a long time, and so it's kind of a movement going on. So what's happening currently? I mean, you got people in New Orleans that are kind of like mobilizing people and traveling to smaller towns, and you know, wanting to get people active, you know, get them registered to vote, get them politically active, talking about the redistricting. But that's how that's going to play out. I mean, they already they've been. That's going to have ramifications on the whole country anyway. So as it stands, they were talking about one black district, you know, instead of two. You know, it was already approved, but, you know, of course, the United States Supreme Court unraveled that. And like I say, we just had an election recently. Let's see. They had, but it's all Republicans. You know, it's amazing that this state has been like predominantly, well, more Democrats than Republicans historically, you know, but we know even like the history of the Dixiecrats, those old Confederate type dudes, well, they still kind of like that too, because they're, you know, what they call, I think the old term, they're blue dogs, I guess you could say, Democrats, where they will vote Republican in many elections, even though they're Democrats, you know. So that's why the governor here, who has a super majority in the state legislature, yeah, I mean, so he's pulling off like executive orders and doing the same like his buddy that's in the White House. You know, he's that dude in the White House, but here this guy is worse because he's got direct effect on the citizens here in Louisiana. So, and I mean, he had several amendments got shot down this past weekend, which was good. You know, I mean, they were trying to, well, his thing is he's trying to control all the state boards and things like that. And now trying to get into teacher retirement trust funds and trying to also, what was another one, major one was, civil service workers, you know, try to kind of dismantle that, making them unclassified workers, putting them in the at will position, meaning because this is an at will state, they can at will fire you. You know, it's a little different than some other states. And so he's trying to get that power, you know, just like they got rid of a lot of folks in the federal government. You know, that was power, you know, the dude had the backing that from the courts and everybody, you know, the knucklehead in the White House. But this governor is kind of, he's mirroring the same thing, trying to establish that institutional power, you know, that government, you know, where he's kind of like the czar and he's appointing his people to be chairman of those, like to say the community college boards or the university boards. You know, there's what, three or four of them. You got the LSU system, you got the Southern system, and you got, it's the regular state system, kind of like the Cal State system. They have, you know, certain schools under that system. So it's like four different, and really four or five, I think it's five altogether, higher education boards. And that's the goal, to control that. You know, he wants to control everything. So, and I tell you though, it was a kind of a slap in the face to him that, you know, they shot down these certain amendments that, you know, that he wanted to gain control. But so now what he's doing is he's retaliating. You know, he's a trip. You know, he's you know, through use of executive orders and then whatever the legislature can pass for him, because they're his. I mean, he has a super majority. They are whatever he wants, kind of like, you know, that's what it is. And so, but there are people that are fighting, you know, but it's, you know, it's on the news, you know, it's people are, you know, expressing themselves, you know, they say, hey, we're going to do this. So what? Try to get people to register to vote. I know, you know, where I'm at, you know, we have like voter registration drives. They'll call me, can, yeah, come, let's do it, you know, set it up, get these, you know, and then have conversations with people, you know. So that's what it is. You know, people don't believe in the system, so to speak, you know, the electoral process in a lot of ways. And this is what we're talking about. You know, that's been an argument. Oh, I don't vote. You know, I don't do this. I don't do that. But at the, especially at the local levels, man, it's like, that's where it has an effect because the federal government, that's the whole point. Let the states do what they want to do. You know, that's what kind of like everybody's on their own island, you know, let them have a king, you know, and that's their goal, their wishes. So, but anyway, that's all I got. But yeah, keep, you know, you know, there are people ignited, and but like I say, we'll stay tuned and see how this grows, because, you know, I know that somebody was saying that, you know, they were, it was groups of people trying to go to different little towns and stuff like that. So I'm looking more into it. I'll keep you updated on it.
Yeah, but y'all doing a good job. They were ready for him. They filed briefs, even though the Supreme Court ruled against some of their appeals already. But they struggled, they organized, had a massive demonstration this past weekend
Right.
and ran other ones. And that's good. At least they're mobilizing. And like you said, they're trying to register. And we got to always remember that we did every inch of freedom and liberation we got was through struggle. It wasn't because of the good heart of white people. Every inch. And they tried to crack back. And you know, when you force their hand, they let you get away with it. But their whole goal is to come back and take back what you won. And that's the key and see. Well, you gotta make a delineation between white prejudicedness and white people that are prejudiced versus a racist system. A white person that don't like you, discriminate against you, that's prejudice. That's just one person or a group of white people. That don't mean that, you know. You can handle that. But when they are in control of life-giving and life-saving goods and services,
Termination,
and
yeah.
in control of the justice system, the distribution of justice and things of this nature, that affects your lives. When they can pass laws and policies that affect the whole group of black people. You run across a white person, you have bad experience with them. That's a prejudicial thing. But when you got a boss that may have a policy that owns a company, and we're not gonna hire no black. I mean any black. You understand? Not just you. And that's what makes a delineation. And but the same thing, he with Detroit. Now Detroit had the second biggest rebellion in the '60s, 1967, and it really led to a lot of progress and the stimulation of the Black Power movement. Are you there?
Yes, Professor.
I know Detroit, I forget the mayor, it went down real bad before they got rid of him. And then you had a couple of Congress people. I know Charles Diggs was from Detroit, and they
Right.
indicted him because he was the only congressman that went to Emmett Till's funeral, court trial when they were trying the white men that killed him. And then the next thing you know, he got indicted. But how do you describe Detroit today as far as this consciousness and as far as this movement? Are you?
Well, Professor Ron, as you so eloquently put it at the very beginning about being satisfied, and we've talked before about the middle class being satisfied, and in spite of it all, digging out a comfortable living for herself and not being politically astute, because, as you said, they're eating, they're able to pay their bills, they may not have the same access as their colleagues at work or fellow students that don't come from the community. But they've carved out enough where they can see the difference between themselves and the rest of their people who may not be as fluent. So now they're being forced to confront the loss of this so-called privilege here. And the activism is reignited. So from the loss of jobs, from loss of access, our middle class is forced to confront those who are taking away or endangering their way of life. And this goes way back, like Brother Ernest was saying about our forefathers and ancestors coming from the South. The line we had up here was they're coming up here because of the opportunity in the factories, the job opportunities outpacing those that are down in the South. And to some degree, that's true. But I, just from talking to some of my elders and some in studying this situation around us, a lot of our people were running from terror. Some of the things that they were subjected to, it's almost unbelievable that humans would do this to one another. Just from just somebody knocking on, and this still happens today. We just had a young man knock on the door. He lost directions and he was on the edge of Dearborn, which is historically was hostile to our people. And he's looking to get directions, and he's knocking on a man's door who comes out, comes to open the door with a shotgun and blows this child away. Well, these were common practices in the South. Not only those, but lynching. From my understanding, even the word picnic comes from pick a nigga and let's sit out here and watch him hang and then we're going to burn him or burn him alive or skin him alive or cut a child out of a woman's belly, throw it to the alligators. Just, oh, man. Anyway, the lynching. These people were running from there. I had a neighbor from Mississippi. And in the summer, most families travel, get the kids, pack them in the station wagon, and we're going to visit your family members and pay tribute to our ancestors, go and clean up the graves and all that kind of stuff. And I asked him, do you ever go back to Mississippi, Mr. Biggs? And he looked at me, and it's the same thing. Like I said earlier, and he said, what for? And even as a child, I could see and understand what he was saying. Even though when we were growing up, we were taught, a predominantly Black environment, city, we were taught about our ancestors and about our forefathers. But Ernest says it's another thing once you get into that working world and you can see it and experience it firsthand. I've had other people tell me one of my best friend's father was a Marine and he came out of Mississippi. He never took his family back to Mississippi to visit any relatives. He kept his sons from joining the Marines. He had experience with my neighbors and a lot of our people have experience. They came from the South, from Virginia all the way Alabama, Mississippi, Louisiana. Incidentally, those white folks down there vote against everything that would make their lives better, from health care to better education. There's no doubt that their states are on the bottom of the list when it comes to education, health care, all those type of things. Because rather than see Black folks get those type of things, white folks will vote against it, even though it will benefit them tremendously. So the hate that they have, especially these poor white folks, it's like, what are you angry about against us? When it's your own people who are denying you access. Like Johnson says, it's a Lyndon Baines Johnson said, what? You can get steal from a white man, reach in his pocket and take the money as long as he feels he's better than you. So, we've done that. We're dealing with that through the history. My city, even though I was protected, we were protected as children, hovered around, like incubated, really. We still had to face that coming out. And it still surprises me that our middle class turned its back on the struggle and had to be forced to confront it when they start losing their privileges. So now, Professor, we're confronted with the 14th Amendment, and they're coming for that. So if you are born in America and not necessarily considered a citizen and provided with the protections that citizens get, what's in the future for us? And the Supreme Court is entertaining this. So where we're at in Detroit had one of the largest middle classes in the city, I mean in the country. Home ownership is one of our pride and joys. Now we're a city of renters. And our middle class is forced, which is really down to nothing. It's just a term, middle class, because it's not like the standard of the middle class, but it's the middle class for us. Are confronted with we out here battling, and it's going to be a hot summer. And I know people personally have lost their jobs and have had to take other jobs or pick up second and third jobs at like hustles. So, Professor, that's where we at in Detroit, like most of America.
But one thing about it, the auto industry through A. Philip Randolph and as he dealt with the Pullman unions, broke up unions that and started their own union and broke up the discrimination, and that's what created a black working class that made decent salaries, which they call middle class salaries. But we never really, from a standpoint of teaching black economics, we don't never had a black middle class in America. We had we because to have a middle class, you had to have a top class, and we had a black top class that see what produces white middle class is rich white people, and they are the ones that provide them the job, so they can be loyal to America and loyal to them. And then the black people that had those jobs that you talked about, good paying jobs where they can buy homes and things of this nature, they had to keep them jobs. Like Ernest was saying, they set you up to get you fired, and
Yes.
and discriminate against you. So you didn't participate or participate in politics and black movements for the most part. But at the same time, you did have organizations in Detroit and strong black ministers in Detroit that spoke their minds and pushed for even more gains for black people in Detroit. And Detroit was always the centerpiece of the black community because of the athletics and entertainment with Motown. That even though it
Also,
was a small company, it employed a lot of people and provided a lot of opportunity. You had the nightclub life, the 20 grand and all of that up and down in Detroit and things of this nature. It was a very enjoyable place to live, but you weren't political as you should have been. Parnell Mitchell and all of those that was there. You have a response to that?
Well, Detroit is a unique city because there's no gerrymandering here.
Because even if you try to gerrymander, you're still going to end up black folk. Going to be the predominant people in that area. So it made our push for political power, it helped it to maintain a steady increase, a steady climb. But still, the powers that be that pull the purse strings and all of that is able to influence our education system was it was top. Our public school system now is like in the gutter, just like being in the South. The powers that be will do whatever they it's just a hatred here. It's a hatred, and I really don't understand it, Professor. I don't understand how you could hate and despise 15, 16, not even 20% of the population to that point, and all you have done is terrorize them. But yet you do everything you can. You spend more time on them than you do on your own people. It's a twisted and sick mentality to say you got to be on your knees in order to make me feel better about myself. So it's here in the city, it's unique because we're a black city still, even at 600,000 people. Used to be a city of 2 million. We're still a black city. And it's even with its increase, you have black people moving back. You have some whites, but black people moving back. The politics remains the same. We are the focal point of the white folks in this state as far as trying to limit our influence and our political power. But we'll keep on pushing on. In spite of it all, they've done everything they can do, from lynchings to taking away power, from our money situation, from the jobs, like you and Ernest were talking about, trying to keep people to shut up, but we're still standing with our what's left of our unions, and Detroit's with this uniqueness, I believe, is going to lead the way in showing how to deal with these devils. We got some plans.
But you got strong leadership and active. See, thing is, as long as you're fighting, you're not losing. That's what's going on with Iran and America. America, we bombed them, we got rid of the Navy, we got rid of the Army, we killed all the leaders, but they're still standing. And they're fighting the Egypt Central War, where they control a vital waterway that's keeping the America and a lot of other countries' economic situation in peril. So you find different ways to fight. You understand the boycott in Montgomery. That was a year-long boycott. But it hurt them that the white folks had to give up the segregation. You see, but it took them a year. And
it hurt their pocketbook.
King said. What Martin Luther King said.
My dad was telling me he had a cousin that worked for the Ford back in like the 20s. And said when they had a big strike and all the guys went out on strike except the janitors and all them. His cousin, they had a janitor force there, about 10 or 12 got, you know, cleaning up black guys. And what happened, it got so bad, said one of the foremen came up to his cousin and said, well, why aren't you, no, a union guy, said, why aren't you guys striking? Say, because you ain't in the union, y'all won't let us join the union. So one of the foremen came up to the black guy, said, you guys know anything about these cars? And you know his cousin, black guys, boy, they knew everything there was to know about cars because they had bought one. They put them together because they were their own mechanics. So he told him, "Say, yeah, we could put these cars together." So they got the janitor force and they start putting the cars together. And so they was putting out almost as many cars as the regular white crews that were out on strike. And say the union guy came to his cousin and said, "Why you guys didn't strike with us and go out?" He said, "Because we ain't in the union. You guys won't let us join the union." So they they let them join. They start joining and say what happened. The union told the foreman, you know, when we come back, then we don't want you to fire the black guys that was taking up the slack while they were out. And so that's kind of how they got in the union to begin with. So I think that was back in the 20s, where they were doing Model Ts and Model A's and stuff.
Yeah. Work. They'll let you work.
Yeah.
If it's to their advantage, but they ain't going to let you vote. They won't share power.
Right.
Power is
I found out how important that vote was because my dad and mom said, hey, when you turn 18 and you register and you go vote. So I vote, and I never really give it a thought. I'd study the issues and stuff and vote, you know, for in my own interest. But when I campaigned for D. Andrews, boys, when I found out how desperately important that one vote is, because I'd come to many people to, well, my one vote ain't gonna make no difference, like Mashinda was saying earlier. And I said, yes, it was, because what happened, D. Andrews, they made a mistake in the district, 6th District, where 14th and 15th Street on Rose Avenue, which is one block, you know, Cherry Avenue, and you come in one block and it's Rose. So what they did, the border went down 10th Street and came down Cherry, came across Anaheim, because Anaheim is about 13th Street, and it came up to 14th Street, and then it came in and took Rose Avenue out, went down to 15th, and then went back to Cherry. With the original map, it should have just went straight down Cherry and included Rose on 14th to 15th. And we went over there and took these, the Cambodians live in there now because they outnumber the blacks now. So there were 12 votes. We went to each of the houses and got them sworn documents that they sent them ballots, not from the 6th district, but for the 7th district. And so they excluded them out of the 6th district. So that was 12 votes. So we went and got all that documented and notarized, took a notary with us. And D had this guy, Paylene, Cambodian guy. We went and got all that verified, talked to the people. And so what happened, Laura Batts, you know, Doris Topsy and them had recommended her. So the city council appointed her temporary in the spot. While they, you know, even before the election, and then and then Doris left, and so she was in there temporary. So when the election come up, she beat D by 4 votes, no, 6 votes. But they had 12 votes they excluded that we had, because these people have voted for D. So they were essentially eliminated. City Tumble, well, she's in there temporary now, so what you have to do is get a $10,000 injunction to try to keep the city from seating her. But while we were running around trying to scuffle that up, they set her in the position, gave her a temporary appointment, and then she ended up getting it. And they totally just ignored this part of the map and those 12 votes that we got. So and then many people, I would go up to the door, knock on the door, and I don't need my one vote. And I tell them this story. I say, hey, my friend lost an election. He lost by 4 votes, but he should have won, had an additional 12. So he should have won by 6, but he lost by 4. So I saw how important that one vote is, you know.
Then Roger Key, what's your perspective on what's going on?
My perspective is it's always the original intent of the United States, when it was established, is the continent, and they just everything in their power to keep things 1% top and 90% mathematically. It's just that type of mentality. And then when you establish a position like they have, when you establish that, you do everything in their power to keep it. So I'm not surprised on their behavior, and it's up to people to not, you know, to resist and not be a participant in the culture of subsisting. As I see it, if we, and I say this quite often, we stop participating in this euphoria, not wisdom, then it collapses that way also. If we start doing things, this example before, the pandemic allow people to do essential things. Doing this things anyway. So if we're in a position, things the way we should, it's going to fight the system also. Protesting, voting, the things we supposed to be doing that make sense, because some don't make sense, the natural system. So I'm taking part in doing different than of the United States, because it's a super. And people participate in it. They think they can get this feeling from being inhumane. It doesn't make sense. So that's sort of what I say at the moment.
See, people be amazed of how cruel people be and how people want to use different excuses to abuse other groups of people. It astounds some people why some white people would hate you and they never met you just because of the color of your skin. You ain't never done nothing to them. You know, generally you dislike somebody because they did something wrong to you. But some people just look at you and just, we're going to kill him, or we're going to bury him, or we're going to tear and feather him. And sometimes people are surprised about the cruelty of other humans to humans. And then you begin to take on some of them practices when you become up under their culture. And so what I'm saying is that, you know, we fight for freedom so we can be ourselves. Freedom to be yourself. Most people on the earth just want to live on the earth. Respect the earth, keep the environment fresh, and things of this nature, and get along with everybody. There are other groups of people who want to rule the earth, take all the precious metals, and enrich themselves, and at the same time, take the most important, most valuable thing is other people on earth. That's the most valuable thing, is another human being. There's no price for another human being. You understand? You can get a price for diamond, gold, oil, $100 a barrel. But you can't price humans. Now they can sell their bodies and body parts and things of this nature. But I'm talking about the essence of humanity. And that's a profound thing, different ways of looking at life. Now here are people that's gonna say that they are a great country, and America's the home of the land. No man's above the law. We treat everybody equal. And then they elect Trump. Not because he had economic plans, not because he was a good person, but because his mentality was make America great again, make America white again. You know, this is our country, and we've let too many immigrants in here. But I'm gonna get some white people from Africa, treat them as refugees. Bring them over here, give them jobs, help them get home, help them get citizen a speedway to citizen so they can vote. Because we got to build the white population back up. I mean, everybody looking at Trump freeing these people, giving them money, pardons, and talking about giving them money. He building his own army. People talking about, oh, he's just letting these criminals go. No. This man, like he knows, one of the biggest areas for militias is Detroit. They got militias way back up in the hills in the mountains.
Yes.
And white militias, white nationalists. What Trump is saying, listen, I'm going to build me an army. ICE is Trump's army. He pays ICE. He pays ICE. He pays, he's going to pay these people that tore up the Capitol. And they're going to be loyal, committed. You understand? And they keep talking about he's corrupt. Well, America's corrupt. The whole country's been corrupt. And Martin Luther King said it. Injustice anywhere is a threat to justice everywhere. And that's what these white folks are doing. They don't see them as doing anything wrong. But when you're in power, you determine what's right and wrong.
Right.
And Judge Higginbotham's book, In a Matter of Color, he said the first thing they do is create the laws of the land and be able to enforce it. You can get a judge, like they have had judges say, tell Trump, bring these people back. You deported them wrong. They ain't brought them back yet. You understand? Because you got to have somebody that will enforce the law. You know, judges don't enforce law. They judge process. That judge can order, take that person to jail. Police don't take me, I don't go. You understand? What could the police do if the police didn't do it? So these are the dynamics that we face with people. It's just a wake-up call for those that don't know, those that should know, and those that want to know. See the beauty. Like I have to tell my students, I learn more from you than you learn from me. I learn how you think as young people. And I learn your skills. And I learn what your values and what your vision is. And that helps me figure out how I can communicate better. And I can understand myself and the world better. It's a complicated situation. Working with people is the hardest thing. Machines you can cut off.
Mm-hmm.
You understand? But humans, my, that's a whole new different game. And so as we work our way through the challenge, the biggest struggle you're gonna have is staying healthy physically. And that's why I admire Rashiki and all y'all to take care of your bodies and your mind. Keep your mind sharp. Keep it functioning so you don't get Alzheimer's or things that they don't just sit on the couch, but you always be inactive. You understand? That's important. Take care of yourself. Always save some time for you. You know, the exercise. Eat less, exercise more. so that you don't have the health problems when you get older. Nobody gave us this education when we was coming up. You understand? But now we know more. And that's why when we say, as Gerard said, our AI is our ancestral intelligence. What is ancestral intelligence? Authentic intelligence. Intelligence based on the lives our ancestors lived. Based on the authentic truth that they tell. Based upon the authentic vision that they had for themselves, their family, and the world. That's our intelligence. Mm-hmm. What they got, what the white man got, his AI is artificial intelligence.
Yes.
Artificial ain't the real thing. And you got to wake up to it.
How much would you believe?
Roger Key, what we got on tomorrow?
For him? Yeah.
Can I ask you a question, Professor?
Yes.
Listen, the point that Roger Key was making up a little earlier about participating in this, did we make more progress from boycotting and protesting as a people as opposed to voting?
They vote. See, most voting is local. School districts, city council.
And if he doesn't respond,
those things are important. Taxes in your local area. And when you're a predominantly black community. See, Watts was never a city. Watts is a district. But the main part of Watts that got the election mayor is in San Pedro. Near San Pedro. But anyway, my point to you is that, yeah, you fight on all fronts. Remember what Malcolm said? The ballot or the bullet. And that we're in position to have a nonviolent revolution through cultural change and political development, political education. Just like what Brother Ernest said, his dad said, I don't want to go back there. But one thing Ernest's dad did, taught them political education. Most of our parents don't teach our kids political education. I mean, listen, man. They don't teach them. The whole purpose of money is not to spend it. Save it unless it's tangible, unless it's essential. You don't spend $40 on fingernails, $400 on tattoo. You don't do that.
No, she's doing her.
Because you're not millionaires, multimillionaire. You understand? If the kids, when we was coming up, had all the money they had that they put in fat man machines and popsicles and crime, they could open up their own business. They'd save their money. Yeah.
Talking around here, talking in the background.
Oh. Go ahead. That was my grandkids, man. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
No, I'm just saying that you hear them in the record.
Yeah, I'm they, man, what can I say? Oh, I hear you. They'd be on the recording. But anyway, let's get to what's going on tomorrow, Rusty. Yeah, but we fight on all fronts. Every front. Every little bit helps. You can fight in different ways, i.e. If you just develop strong black children, that's resistance. You understand? If you be a strong father, that's resistance. That's progress. Strong mothers and strong people, spiritual, all kind of ways in which you can contribute to the movement. All of us are not going to be soldiers. Don't ask for all of us to be united. Ain't no people on this planet require all their people to be united. Trump just got 30% of the Republican vote that's solid, but he runs the Republican Party. Just 30 to 40%. The other 60%, half of them don't vote at all. You know, they're hippies, they're on drugs, they're doing this. So he rules it. So every little bit of help. Fight with what you got and what you can fight with. But the whole goal is, are you fighting for liberation? Freedom to be yourself. All right, Rashi P. Next week, or Wednesday, tomorrow.
We got Daryl Brooks. He came on before, licensed clinical worker. And he's a fairly young guy, and education was really good. So I invited him. So his medical versus mental stigma. It's going to be, he's going to present information, and then we're going to discuss.
All right, then. Well, I got tentatively three people, Brother Keeley of Black Lives Matter, Dr. Molina of Black Lives Matter, Molefe Asante of Temple University, and then somebody else. But I'll get with you. Whoever confirmed,
And that will be the anniversary. So it's actually Tuesday 26th. The 26th will be the anniversary, Professor Ra.
Yeah, and that's a beautiful thing. You know why? That's African Liberation Day.
26th?
Well, it started on the 27th, then there's one on the 25th. And then there's one on Memorial Day. And I'll explain all of that on Tuesday. Okay. For African Liberation Day. You're going to have African Liberation Day celebrations this coming Saturday all over L.A. County. You know, so I'm going to get into a little bit of it. All right.
Years ago, on the 25th, Conscious Corner, which is now the Black Conscious
Corner. Yeah, that's right. Black Conscious. Yeah.
Right. Well, each one teach Black Conscious Corner.
All right. You take care, my brother. Love all y'all, brothers. Stay strong. Stay healthy. Take time out for yourself.
Yes, sir. Thank you. Love you back. Yes.
All right. Later.